First World War Myths, Lies and Distortions, Part 4, The Somme Campaign, A Needless and Futile Slaughter, by Blown Periphery. No campaign sums up the nation's understanding or perception of the First World War as effectively as the campaign and series of battles on the Somme from 1 July until November of 1916. To many, it encapsulates all that was wrong with the conduct and leadership of the British forces in the Great War. It is widely perceived as a futile and unnecessary slaughter, whose objectives could never have been achieved, and it probably lengthened the war by at least a year. The 60,000 British casualties sustained on the first day, 1 July 1916, said it all, didn't it? History is always about context, and it is unwise to judge events from the safety of distance, time and hindsight. The French were the ultimate proponents of offensive action. A huge area of their country was occupied by the Germans, and not unreasonably, they wanted them out. The British, with their much smaller army, did not want to engage in mass battles of attrition, to wear down the enemy for little material gain. The British preferred to build up their army both numerically and logistically and strike a quick blow that may win the war, or at least provide an advantage that could be exploited. But whether we liked it or not, Britain was the junior partner and had to accede to French strategic aims. Plans for operations in 1916 were formulated at the Chantilly Conference in December 1915, where offensive action would be conducted in 1916, the question being where. Sir Douglas Haig had taken over command of the BEF in that December, and he was of the opinion that the offensive should be in Flanders, around Ypres, to sever German railway communications and move British forces from the waterlogged and overlooked positions onto the higher ground. The French favoured a British offensive at the Somme, which was closer to their positions and could provide flanking support to the strategically and nationally important town of Verdun. The French implied that the British never made efficient use of its manpower, which the British countered by pointing out that the 2 million men in the Royal Navy provided freedom of the seas and degraded Germany's ability to wage total war. The French remained unimpressed. The aims of the two allies also differed. Joffre saw the planned offensive as a battle of attrition, put bluntly, to kill Germans. Haig hoped to penetrate the German lines and mount a breakout. The British Army was still a largely volunteer force, which Haig was reluctant to squander in the meat grinder of attrition warfare. The original plan called for an offensive over a 60-mile stretch, with the French providing the bulk of the troops, but this was thrown into confusion when the Germans mounted an offensive of their own at Verdun, in March 1916. Verdun holds a mystical significance to the French. It was captured by the Germanic tribes in 923 and recaptured in 1552. It was besieged during the 30 Years' War and held by the French Revolutionary Army, and in 1870 it was the last fortress to fall to the Prussians. It would have made sense for the French to give up Verdun and its forts in 1914, to shorten their line in more easily defended area, but its symbolic importance should not be underestimated. The Germans saw an attack on Verdun as a means of knocking Britain out of the war. Germany was not concerned about the small British army in France, but in the Royal Navy and British money and her empire. The Germans planned to grind the French down, to bleed them white, to force a collapse of French morale, destroy France's will to fight, which would inevitably lead to British troops leaving France. As a strategy, it nearly succeeded and formed the basis for Germany's resounding victory over the French and British in 1940. Image: The Verdun Offensives 1915-16. The Somme Offensive would still take place. Moreover, it was now imperative to remove pressure from the French at Verdun. The planned French involvement of 42 divisions and 356 heavy guns over 22 miles of front had to be scaled back to 22 divisions over 7.5 miles. Additionally, the French now had more favorable ground astride the Somme River to attack over, with the British protecting their left flank and the bulk of the French army to their right. The withdrawal of half the French forces caused the British planning staff a logistical nightmare. British units had to move into the areas of the front that the French had left. Some 30 miles of trenches, and there was widespread disgust among British units at the state the French had left their trenches in. A major problem for the staff was a shortfall of ammunition for the guns and the need to redeploy many batteries. Each battery of 18-pounder guns would need 1,000 rounds at the battery, with a battery reserve of 250 rounds per gun. The 6-inch howitzers required 650 rounds with a core reserve of 200 rounds per gun. The road network was in a poor state of repair and not suitable for military traffic. In one 24-hour period, 26,536 men, 76 guns and carriages, 1,806 motor vehicles, 3,756 horse-drawn vehicles, 5,404 men on horseback and 1,043 bicycles passed down a rural side road. New roads were built and others widened to allow for the vast logistical train for the offensive. Troops had to be briefed, trained and equipped, moved into position and sustained. The Royal Flying Corps and Royal Naval Air Service aircraft flew countless missions to try and prevent German reconnaissance aircraft from photographing the scale of the preparations. The only bomb that fell anywhere near the British build-up was dropped accidentally by a British aircraft. Between August 1914 and June 1916, the BEF increased from 4 infantry divisions to 58. All this was planned and organized by what has become perceived as the hated, effete, trench-dodging staff officers. In 1914 the BEF's general staff consisted of 22 staff officers. In 1916 there were just 30. On the 16th of June 1916 the orders to British units were issued. Any ideas of a breakout were shelved due to the changed circumstances, and the orders clearly stated, the 3rd and 4th armies will undertake offensive operations on the front Maricourt to Gommecourt in conjunction with the French 6th Army astride the Somme, with the object of relieving pressure on the French at Verdun and inflicting losses on the enemy. My italics. Phase 1 was to seize positions along the Pozières ridge and between Sir and Ancre. This would get the British on to higher ground with better observation. The second phase would be entirely dependent on the success or otherwise of phase 1, with a possible breakout should conditions be favourable. The orders for the subsequent phases of the offensive may seem to be vague, but did make tactical sense in as much as they allowed the divisional commanders freedom of action with the ability to amend plans according to the situation. The tragedy was that in 1916, events moved faster than communications and intelligence, and they were unable to keep up with, or get inside the enemy's OOD loop. This resulted in the British being unable to exploit the gains they had made in the initial stages of the battle. Image. The Boyd OOD loop. The main British assault units were from the 4th Army, consisting of 16 divisions and nearly half a million men. 11 divisions would attack on the first day. 3 were regular divisions, 4, 8 and 29, 5 were new army formations, 18, 31, 32, 34 and 36, and 3, 7, 21 and 30, were a mix of territorial and new army formations. The territorial and new army formations were undertrained and the regular divisions were brought up to strength by men fresh out of training. It was an inexperienced force and soldiering had become much more sophisticated as the war progressed. The real weakness was at the NCO/junior officer levels, and leadership at this level is vital in the confusion, noise and general hellishness of battle. General Haig was well aware of the limitations of his troops, but hoped that the overwhelming preliminary bombardment would shake the German defences, destroy dugouts and bunkers and cut swathes in the wire, which in places was up to 40 feet thick. The engineers and gunners calculated that a 4-day preliminary bombardment would be sufficient to collapse the German dugouts and blast paths through the wire. Before 0 hour there would be a final 80 minutes of intense bombardment, which it was hoped would force the surviving Germans back into the support trenches while the British infantry were moving forward. The British air component would attempt to keep German observation aircraft and balloons on the ground during the offensive. The bombardment commenced at 6 o'clock on 24 June 1916, but low cloud and mist hampered attempts by Allied observation aircraft to ascertain the effectiveness of the barrage and counter-battery fire. Because of this, the offensive was postponed for 48 hours and would commence at 7:30 hours on 1 July. The British infantry would have preferred to go in as dawn was breaking, but General Foch and the British artillery preferred a daylight offensive so that the guns observers could make their final adjustments. During the bombardment, the British fired 1,508,652 rounds, 7 shells for every yard of the front. Trench raids were conducted during lulls in the bombardment, so that the effectiveness of the barrage could be gauged. Reports were sketchy and 8 Corps reported the barrage was not particularly effective. Haig was skeptical of these reports as 8 Corps was new to the Western Front. However, it had previously served in Gallipoli. All other signs seemed promising and fires were burning in the German rear areas. Image. The Somme Offensive 1916. Communication trenches or saps were dug out into no man's land as jumping off points. The first waves went into their positions, lay down and waited, surrounded by their comrades but alone with their thoughts and fears. The initial attack would consist of 4 waves, each following the previous wave at a distance of 100 yards. At 0 hour the barrage would be lifted from the German first line and move back to the second line of trenches. The agreed safety distance between advancing own troops and the barrage was set at 100 yards. At 6:30 hours the troops moved out of the forward and communications trenches into no man's land and lay down. Just before 7:33 huge mines under the German positions were blown. The whistle sounded and the first wave stood up and advanced at a walking pace. The wind blew away the smoke screen and as soon as the British guns moved to the second line, the Germans emerged from their dugouts, set up the machine guns and trench mortars and before the British had advanced 50 yards, the killing started. Image. The Lochnigy crater caused by a subterranean explosive mine dug under German positions. On the extreme left of the British line was the 31 Division made up of 3 brigades and comprised almost exclusively of PALs but Allians. This division was to prevent the Germans from attacking the flanks and after advancing 150 yards, they found the wire was still intact. The left-hand brigade consisting of 12 Battalion York and Lancaster Regiment, Sheffield City PALs, had 7 officers and 241 men killed that morning. The 11 Battalion East Lancashire Regiment, Accrington PALs, lost 5 officers and 113 men. The 2 battalions of West Yorkshire Regiment, Leeds and Bradford PALs lost 23 officers and 296 men killed. It would be difficult to pass such losses off as anything other than a slaughter. On the extreme right flank of the British line was another PALs division. The 30th, which was tasked with capturing the village of Montauban and the German trenches leading up to a redoubt known as the Dublin Redoubt. This was to be captured by the French. The British and German positions were over 1,000 yards apart in this section, and although saps had been dug, the 30th Division still had to advance some 750 yards. 3 battalions of the Liverpool PALs and 8 Territorial Battalion, the 2nd Bedfords advanced across the gulf between the front lines. Despite attacking strongly held positions, all of the first day's objectives were taken for the loss of 45 killed of all ranks. In between the results varied considerably, but nobody can deny that the loss of over 57,470 British casualties, 19,240 of whom were killed on the first day alone, was a national catastrophe. Despite the losses of the first day, General Haig continued with the offensive. Some gains were made, but these were limited and German counterattacks recaptured lost ground. Haig was convinced that the Germans were exhausted and on the verge of collapse, and as a result of this belief, The offensive was carried on throughout the summer and into November. The reasoning was also political in as much as it was necessary to maintain pressure on the German forces to relieve pressure on the French at Verdun. Battle of Bazentin Ridge, 14-17 July. The 4th Army attacked the German 2nd defensive position from the Somme past Guillemont and Ginchy, northwest along the crest of the ridge to Pozières on the Albert-Bapaume road. The objectives of the attack were the villages of Bazentin-le-Petit, Bazentin-le-Grand and Longueville, which was adjacent to Delville Wood, with Highwood on the ridge beyond. The attack was made by 4 divisions on a front of 6,000 yards at 3:25 a.m. after a 5-minute hurricane artillery bombardment. Field artillery fired a creeping barrage and the attacking waves pushed up close behind it in no man's land, leaving them only a short distance to cross when the barrage lifted from the German front trench. Most of the objective was captured and the German defense south of the Albert-Bapaume road put under great strain, but the attack was not followed up due to British communication failures, casualties and disorganization. Haig renewed attacks in this area again between 25-27 September, in the Battle of Morville and the Battle of Thpval Ridge. British advances were small but were consolidated upon. Other attacks were launched by the British at the Battles of Transloy Ridges, 1-20 October, and the Battle of the Ancre Heights, 1-11 October. Similarly, French attacks were continued in the south around Chaulnes, and in the centre east of Morville. In October, Joffre urged Haig to continue the offensive. By this time, the French forces in Verdun were on the offensive and were gaining ground. Joffre was concerned that Haig should keep up the pressure on the Germans so as to prevent a diversion of German manpower back to Verdun to assist with the German defense there. On the 13th of November, the BEF made a final effort on the far east of the salient in the Battle of the Ancre, in which they captured the field fortress of Beaumont-Hamel. Despite the slow but progressive British advance, poor weather with snow brought a halt to the Somme offensive on the 18th of November. During the attack, the British and French had advanced the front line by 8 miles, the taking of which resulted in 420,000 estimated British casualties, including many of the Volunteer PALS battalions, plus a further 200,000 French casualties. German casualties were estimated to run at around 500,000. The preliminary bombardment. Expansion of the Royal Artillery had resulted with the rush to increase the production of guns and howitzers abandoned higher standards of quality and led to a number of defects. The British stocks of shells consisted of a high number of faulty, or dud shells. As many as 30% of shells failed to explode and had no effect. Additionally, much of their stockpile, around two-thirds, consisted of shrapnel shells, ineffective against wire and hardened defenses, and the number of high explosive shells was limited. Supply had struggled to keep up with demand, and the problems which caused great political scandal throughout 1915, and partially led to the downfall of Prime Minister Asquith, had not yet been fully rectified. The ambitious goal set by then Minister of Munitions, Lloyd George, in January 1916 was that the crisis would be resolved and more than adequate numbers of shells would be produced by April that year. In reality, it was not until spring 1917 the British Army was finally free of the crippling shortages. As they had planned to destroy defences and suppress the defenders, it becomes easy to criticise the tactical choices of Haig and Rawlinson for the limited value of their bombardment. However, the shell crisis, the increased expectations placed on them by the French, and the vast expansion of the army all placed further pressure on British generals, forcing them to meticulously review plans, in which they wished to strengthen the artillery to reduce the burden on their substandard divisions. By adding 2 days to the bombardment, it is clear Allied generals recognized the shortfalls and, in spite of these pressures, temporarily put the military situation ahead of logistical and political, although bad weather also played a major role. However, no additional shells were allocated, not even the much-needed high-explosive varieties. In subsequent battles, the weight of fire of bombardments increased, and usually it was laid in shorter time periods. This is partly due to the deliberate allocation of more shells in planning and the lessons learned, and partly due to better production. The Battle of Messines, 11 months later, utilized twice as many field guns per yard, and three times the heavy artillery, than deployed at the Somme. At least 3.25 million shells were fired in support of the attack at Messines, considerably more than the 1.73 million fired along the Somme, and developments allowed for much more accurate and effective fire. Defensive positions held by the German army on the Somme after November 1916 were in poor condition, the garrisons were exhausted, and censors of correspondence reported tiredness and low morale in front-line soldiers. The situation left the German command doubtful that the army could withstand resumption of the battle. The German defense of the Ancre began to collapse under British attacks, which on the 28th of January 1917 caused Rupprecht to urge that the retirement to the Siegfriedstellung Hindenburg line begin. Ludendorff rejected the proposal the next day, but British attacks on the First Army, particularly the action of Miremont, 17-18 February, caused Rupprecht on the night of the 22nd of February to order a preliminary withdrawal of circa 4 miles, 6.4 kilometers, to the Ahr-Eisteilung, Ahr-Ei position. On the 24th of February the Germans withdrew, protected by rearguards, over roads in relatively good condition, which were then destroyed. The German withdrawal was helped by a thaw, which turned roads behind the British front into bogs, and by disruption to the railways which supplied the Somme front. On the night of the 12th of March, the Germans withdrew from the Ahr-Eisteilung between Bapaume and Achaia-Klapeti, and the British reached the Ahr-Eisteilung, Ahr-II position, on the 13th of March 1917. It could be said that the Somme offensive did keep France in the war, but would it really have been such a disaster for the British if the French had collapsed, forcing the Bethe out of France? And would the French army have collapsed for the loss of Verdun, whose significance was probably more important to politicians and chauvinists than the generals? The Royal Navy was still supreme, as was the Empire. Perhaps the U-boat offensive could have cut supplies and trade routes, bringing Britain to her knees, and it would have resulted in Germany being the dominant power in Europe. And in the last few years, we've all learned just how dangerous that situation is. So was it all a futile and unnecessary slaughter? The neat rows of white gravestones are a powerful reminder of what industrialized warfare is about, and I think the jury's still out on the answer to necessity and effectiveness of the Somme offensive. In the final analysis, I find it very difficult to put a positive spin on the battles and grieve for the young lives who could have given our country so much. Copyright Blown Periphery 2018.